The viewpoints expressed in the following program are not necessarily those of WRUU, its license holder, or its staff. The following program contains subject matter and realistic language that some listeners may find objectionable. Listener discretion is advised. Well, good afternoon, Savannah. It is just past 12 o'clock on this Friday, and that means you're now listening to Literature with Lee and PT. So, PT, we have sort of what's become an annual event here on Listening to Literature for today's episode, and maybe a couple more episodes between now and about February the 14th.
Well, wouldn't we be silly not to cover the Savannah Book Festival?
Yes, the 2020 Savannah Book Festival. That is happening here in downtown Savannah, February 13th through February 16th. The keynotes, the opening, the closing lectures are at the Trustees Theater. And then Festival Saturday, which is Saturday, February the 15th. I didn't count this time, PT, but there are more than 40 authors coming.
Wow.
Yeah, I think it might even be close to 50. It seemed like quite a bit. And all of those are open to the public. And if you go to savannahbookfestival.org, you can find information about the major addresses, but also about that festival Saturday. Figure out when the authors are speaking during that day, where they will be. I usually have a tendency to pick out who I want to see and then map it all out so that I can arrange it.
I think everybody does it that way because inevitably there are two people speaking at the same time
always.
That you really want to see. And at the keynote, this time is John Grisham, is that right?
That is correct. So John Grisham is the keynote, and then the keynote is on Friday, February the 14th. I'm not sure if John Grisham is usually known for Valentine's Day types of literature.
I would suspect not.
But he is Friday, February the 14th at 6 p.m. at the Trustees Theater. And in part, he will be talking about a new novel of his called The Guardians. Now, interestingly enough, PT, I've loved Grisham, you know, because I like The Law and I think he's a great writer. Mm-hmm. I've even loved most of the film adaptations, which I think is pretty rare when you're a book lover. I did not know until I went to the festival's website to take a look at John Grisham's bio. He actually has written quite a bit more than just The Law.
He's
got a very, very interesting background. I think most people know that he actually did practice law in Mississippi. He also served two terms in the State House of Representatives, which I didn't know. You're shaking your head like you did know that, PT. I guess I'm just a little behind the times.
Not really. That stuff isn't well known, but if you get curious about his background and where he gets his ideas from, you start to read biographical material and some of that comes out.
Right. Now, he has written a collection of short stories, books about sports. He even has a comic novel, 7 editions of his Theodore Boone, which is a series for children. Of course, legal thrillers. I think that's how most of us know him. And one work of nonfiction, which, of course, a lot of his books have been turned into films or some kind of adaptation. His work of nonfiction was turned into a series on a stream. I think it's on Netflix. I'll have to double check that. The Last Innocent Man.
I am not familiar with that, but I remember hearing the title.
It is, from my perspective, the series was a great look at the process of our legal system when it comes to someone accused of murder. Someone I know actually just gave me a copy of the book, and I can't wait to dig into Grisham's book. He, of course, has also been on the board of the Innocence Project, which most people know the Innocence Project helps people who have been imprisoned for crimes when they say they're innocent. The Innocence Project will take on certain cases and try to help, you know, prove their innocence. And I think that's what The Guardians is about a horrific murder of a lawyer. I don't know if Grisham is, you know, playing around here a little bit with, you know, but a horrific murder of a lawyer and in the South in Florida. And a young black man is sentenced to life in prison. He spends 22 years in prison for this murder. And he contacts the Guardian Project, similar to the Innocence Project, and finds a lawyer who's gonna help work through his case. And that lawyer who's working through his case starts to realize, there might be more to this mystery than this murder than anyone actually knows. And whoever murdered this lawyer 22 years ago might actually be willing to murder another one. So it's supposed to, I really like how it brings together a lot of Grisham's background while still also being kind of one of his traditional legal thriller with legal twists.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, listening to him talk should be very interesting for those of us who are still working on our first novel.
Yes, I know. it's so encouraging and so humbling to read through the list of all the authors who are participating in the Savannah Book Festival, because it is amazing the kind of talent that is there and folks who have, well beyond their first novel, although there are a lot of debut authors as well. We're going to talk about one debut author today, but in maybe an upcoming episode,
when you find debut authors, they are debuting for books, but they still have some pretty extensive backgrounds in writing.
That's right. It's usually not, I woke up one day and decided to become a highly published author and boom, it happened. I think most writers know there's more blood, sweat, and tears that go into that. Now, PT, before we get into the authors we want to talk about today, let me also let our listeners know about the other major lectures at the festival. So we already talked about the keynote, which is Friday, February the 14th. The opening lecture is on Thursday, February 13th at 6:30 p.m. at the Trustees Theater. And that's Joseph Cannon. And he's going to be talking about his book, The Accomplice. And this is a espionage novel about so set in World War II, or maybe post-World War II, a Nazi, someone who's accused of being a Nazi, and the CIA chasing to track this down. Let me find my notes here, and I can tell our listeners a little more about that. This is another, I love the law, but this is definitely up my alley as well. All right. So the blurb on the Savannah Book Festival's page says, The Accomplice is a heart-pounding and intelligent espionage novel about a Nazi war criminal who was supposed to be dead, the rogue CIA agent on his trail, and the beautiful woman connected to them both.
Oh, isn't there always?
Of course. So this is really up my alley. But one of the other things that intrigues me about Joseph Cannon, he has written 8 other novels and has won a Hammett Award.
Okay.
International Association Award of Crime Writers, right? He's also won the Anne Frank Human Writers Award for his writings on the aftermath of the Holocaust. He used to be a book publishing executive before I think he turned to writing full time. So he brings a lot of not only background in terms of historical background, but I also, obviously he's been recognized. He also won an Edgar Award for his first novel, The Good German.
Uh-huh.
And people might recognize The Good German.
Yeah.
Right. And how so, PT?
And I hope they recognize the Edgar Award.
I hope they recognize the Edgar Award as well. So he's got a lot of awards propping up his prior work, and we'll have to see what The Accomplice is like. And then lastly, the closing address is on Sunday, February the 16th, and it's a dual team, John Becker and Megan Scott, who have updated The Joy of Cooking.
Yes,
and you're a cook, PT, aren't you?
As opposed to a chef, definitely.
Well, you actually might be a chef as well. I basically do the dishes. That's what I do.
Okay. Well, no, I do more of the work closer to the heat.
You see, yeah. And do you have a copy of The Joy of Cooking?
As a matter of fact, we do. Not an updated one at all. Ours is the original.
Pretty tattered at this stage, huh?
It's got some age on it. But I think this book has to be pretty special because so many people have the original book that any update to it is really going to have to prove its stuff.
Absolutely. The original is fairly sacrosanct.
Oh, yes.
Right. Well, now, interestingly enough, John Becker is the great-grandson of Irma Rombauer.
Aha.
Yes. And so he and Megan started working for The Joy of Cooking in 2010. The two of them together have basically been updating The Joy of Cooking, testing out and tweaking recipes, adding some new recipes, trying to update some recipes for today's kitchen gadgets, for today's access to different ingredients via like farmers markets and things like that. So
one of the biggest differences between cooking now and cooking when that first came out is there's a tremendous amount more available than there was back then.
Absolutely. So I think this new edition of The Joy of Cooking will reflect that. And I hope all of the chefs and cooks out there in the world will make tasty things for me.
I can't say I'm looking forward to it exactly, but when I encounter it, I will certainly take a close look at it.
All right. Now, today, you and I, so we're going to talk mostly about the Festival Saturday authors, and we certainly cannot get through all 40, almost 50 of them in one episode.
I would hope not.
I don't know if you and I are going to be able to get through maybe four or five of them today, but we sort of picked a little selection. I don't know if there's a theme for our selection. Part of that theme might be books that we're really interested in, but also
I think what we've done here is we focused a little more on the nonfiction books.
Yeah, you and I, we do have a bias toward that. We love great fiction writing and great novel writing, but you and I both tend to read a lot of nonfiction.
We do.
And these nonfiction books, they all have a little bit of a biography bent to them, where some of them are real biographies. Some
right.
of them might not necessarily be biographies, but have a biographical vein.
And I can think of some of them that have biographies that may have some fictional elements to
yes.
them.
Right. Yes, absolutely. And PG, I sort of thought we'd go in chronological order. I don't know if that's the best approach.
I'm going to leave that up to you, Lee.
All right, I'm in control of the board, so that means
you are
in
control of the board.
I'm in control of you for at least the next 40 minutes.
You have the commanding finger. Do as you feel.
Well, the first is actually sort of a dual biography going back to our founding fathers, Franklin and Washington.
Yes.
The Founding Partnership.
Yes.
Now, this is a book by a historian, a professor of history, Edward J. Larson. And the book itself doesn't come out until February. So usually I love with new books, I know most people are like this, I go online and I want to read that excerpt that I can read through,
right.
You know, whatever, wherever you want to buy your books. Ah, the excerpt isn't out yet because the book isn't out yet. So it's made me, I think, anticipate this book even
well,
more.
Well, it's the subject is been fairly well covered before, and of course, people who do biographies are sort of under the gun to provide a little more insight, write a little more elegantly.
Right.
And Mr. Larson is, or actually Professor
Larson that's right.
is certainly a person who can do that. So I'm anticipating it too. One thing I hope, I have no idea whether he will or not, but one thing that I hope he will cover is the continuation of the friendship and their impact on America after the revolution has succeeded.
Right.
It became obvious to several people that the American form of government under the Articles of Confederacy weren't going to work. In Washington's case, it became obvious that his army wasn't going to get paid, which is more than inconvenient.
Yes.
That's a great reason or a frequent reason for revolutions to fail or to fall to counter-revolutions.
You're absolutely right.
And the need for a strong federal component became fairly obvious to a lot of people. even though some of the more leading lights were dealing with more regional issues or taking more regional outlooks.
Right.
One person I've been reading about just lately in another context was John Randolph of Virginia, who was nothing if not a localist. But these are two men who had much to do with the Articles of Confederation becoming the Constitution, and if nothing else, they should be honored for that.
You know, absolutely. And I do believe that Larson's biography, or dual biography is I think how people are phrasing it, does go into that. They were very different men, separated by 26 years of age.
They were not. Neither one of them invited the other over for beer and Skittles, but they were certainly prolific letter writers, and they were political allies, to be sure.
Absolutely. And for much of their three-decade friendship and alliance, I think Franklin was overseas quite a bit of that time.
Right.
So you're right. So a lot of the interaction between the two men happened via letter. And some of the early reviews I've read of Larson's book said, well, you know, look, sometimes, you know, their interactions aren't so exciting because they weren't two men at the same place in the same time.
But quite often separated.
Right. But, you know, Larson can't change history that way. But going, but yes, Larson, I think, takes the tactic that that both Washington and Franklin, in addition to James Madison, are really the constructors of the American experiment as we know
they
it.
Are, there are other people who should be considered, but they are two of the main guys.
Right, right. And interestingly enough, they, of course, both Washington and Franklin were British loyalists way back in the day, and they sort of, you know, came over to the other side of things as we now know them. And one aspect that's highlighted in some of the reviews about Larson's book is how Washington really supported a strong presidency. Franklin was a little wary of that, but he went along with it.
Well, yeah, I think Washington was confronted with the results of a weak presidency much earlier than anyone
right.
else, and understood the need for strength there.
Right. So very, very different men. Like we said, 26 years difference in age, right? You know, Franklin, especially by the time that he and Washington really started collaborating on this, you know, was wealthy, you know, had been a printer, was a scientist, was politically active, of course, but very, you know, and sort of a northern abolitionist, right? Whereas Washington, southern slaveholder, and a very different route. They're very different men, and so that's
very different.
That's what makes I really like Larson's perspective on let's look at these two men together rather than just tell separate tales.
Well, again, there's a good bit of correspondence between the two that you can base this on, and they did know each other. I mean, like I said, they weren't playing poker every Friday night, but they did know each other.
Right.
And I think they appreciated each other's support.
Yeah, very much so. Now, the Kirkus Review, very positive about Larson's dual biography, but it does say, look, to call them partners is a bit of a stretch.
It is.
Yeah. Right. And Kirkus Review says, look, few original insights, but fine biographies. And I believe this is, I'm trying to think if this is the, oh no, it's the next book we're going to talk about. Obviously, Larson knows his stuff. It's well researched. A lot of, I think, the information for the book does come from letters and from documentation. Right now, if you're interested in the book, you can go online and see some images of some of the documentation that Larson used. But we got to wait, I think, at least a few more weeks before
well,
we can get
wait,
an excerpt.
Then wait, we will.
Right. So one of the next books that we picked, we're going to fast forward a little bit as well, but also a central time period, still a central time period in the history of the United States. And that, of course, is the Civil War.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Now, the book that we're going to talk about next, obviously a well-known campaign, but one of the smaller campaigns is the focus of this book, and that's Vicksburg.
Well, I'm not sure it was that small.
Okay. All right.
It didn't have the massive numbers of soldiers that, let's say, Gettysburg did, to be sure.
Right.
But it was one of the more significant campaigns. And one thing that always gives me a lot of amusement is people say what a classic campaign it is. And that is utter nonsense.
You're absolutely right.
Because the Union went in there with very specific things in mind, failed at all of them.
Yes.
tried something else. That failed, too.
Right.
And it was just really a matter of perseverance.
Right. It was a very long campaign in that sense.
It was a very long campaign because they were dealing with a very critical area. If you look at the map of Vicksburg even today, it's very close to both the border of Tennessee and the border of Arkansas.
Right.
And this was a critical area that there were some pretty strong Confederate forces dealing with. So the first thing they had to do, the Union, that is, was deal with the Confederate forces that were completely separate from Vicksburg. And the second thing they had to do was deal with the strength of Vicksburg itself.
Right.
And that included dealing with the Mississippi River at that
yes.
point, which was a problem all in itself.
Right. But vital to the Confederacy.
Absolutely, absolutely. When the Union captured Port Hudson and Vicksburg, which sort of went together,
right.
That separated Arkansas and Texas from the rest of the Confederacy.
Right.
And so this was something that was very important to do.
Well, and that Mississippi River was just crucial for the Confederacy to be able to get supplies.
Absolutely. And with the Union having the complete control of the river, they could steam things up from newly captured New Orleans.
Right.
Clear up to the battlefields in the Midwest and back down again. So it was a significant thing. And Donald Miller, who wrote this book.
Yes, and the book is called Vicksburg, Grant's Campaign That Broke the Confederacy.
And it did. And I have read Masters of the Air, which is a previous book by him. I'm anticipating this book too.
Well, let's continue to talk about Donald Miller's Vicksburg, but PT, we're already at our halfway mark.
Well, then let us do so.
So let's take a brief break for station identification and a few announcements. And when we come back here on Listening to Literature, we'll continue previewing some of the many, many books and many authors who will be at the Savannah Book Festival 2020.
This is WRUU-LP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings Community Radio with Global Soul.
How many times have you heard WRUU's corporate underwriting message? If you remember it, then your potential customers remember your message as well. We are offering this space to connect corporate and institutional partners with our loyal and active listeners. Underwriting on WRUU is short, so listeners don't tune out. It's exclusive, so your message won't be lost in advertising clutter. And it supports Savannah's only community radio station. For a marketing package to increase your reach beyond traditional media, email underwriting@wruu.org.
This portion of WRUU Savannah Sounding Programming is brought to you by listeners and the 2020 Savannah Music Festival, presenting Global Roots music artists Zakir Hussain Trio, Marta Pereira de Costa with Germaine Lopez, Vassen with Kittle & Company, Martin Hayes Quartet, Brenda Navarette, and more. Information at savannahmusicfestival.org.
Well, welcome back to Listening to Literature here on WRUU 107.5 FM. Today, PT and I are previewing some of the many, many authors and books that will be at the Savannah Book Festival in February, about a month from now.
Yes.
And we were talking about Donald Miller's Vicksburg, Grant's campaign that broke the Confederacy right before the break. Now, you know, if you're wondering how much research Donald Miller did for this book.
Oh, my.
Apparently, the back matter runs about 150 pages.
Yes.
Now, I have a tendency to sometimes love footnotes even more than an author's actual, but, you know, I'll challenge our listeners out there to go through every single one of those pages as they're reading Miller's latest creation.
I will say that one thing Miller's share... Miller's book share, that is there's a pretty good amount of material to look at, and he has the fortitude to go look at most of it.
Right.
There were a lot of people who wrote letters from Vicksburg during the siege or during the battles that went around, Union soldiers, Confederate
soldiers on all
inhabitants
sides.
Of Vicksburg,
right.
Et cetera, et cetera.
Absolutely.
And part of the campaign was the capture of Jackson, Mississippi, too. And there again, there's a whole trove of material to go through. Mm-hmm. And finding an author who can go through them and come up, well, even with a coherent
right.
narrative, is pretty special. And Mr. Miller fits that.
Yeah, now he is a professor as well.
Professor Miller.
Yeah, so he knows what he's talking. Not all of us professors do, but he seems like he knows what he's talking about. Now, PT, you were mentioning about how difficult it was for the Union to, you know, wrest control of Vicksburg from the Confederacy. And Miller does, you know, talk about this, you know, in April 1862, Admiral David Farragut had taken New Orleans, like you had mentioned. And then, you know, they try sort of this Navy bombardment and that just completely fails. Grant's first attempt fails. Sherman tries a few months later. That fails. He tried taking Vicksburg by storming it via the Chickasaw Bayou. And this was a really horrible outcome for the Union. They lost nearly 2,000 men, and the Confederates only lost about a couple hundred.
Yeah, but if you look at the campaign overall, the figures are much larger.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah.
But part of it was simply the fact of having to stomp through the bayous and the swamps before you could even get to a place where you could join a battle.
Right. Now, didn't Grant also try to sort of dig his own canal at one point?
He did, and that didn't work.
So it, well, either.
Digging canals is not... is not a forte for armies in the field. But it eventually succeeded when Farragut was able to run the batteries at Vicksburg and provide the support they needed for amphibious operations.
Right. Now, John Gordon Steele, who is also an author, and I believe he's also a professor. I'm sorry, John Steele Gordon, also a professor, was reviewing Donald Miller's Vicksburg book. And he writes, Mr. Miller notes that this was the first time in the war that dug-in defenders dominated the battlefield. Confederate soldiers facing Sherman's rushing lines fought from trenches they had constructed. It was a harbinger of future Civil War battles and, more broadly, of future warfare. And this, of course, is in what I really like about this passage, and I'm sure you see it in Miller's book, is that he's also linking the Civil War to future wars and to, you know,
he was.
Why it matters
the,
even after
the sort,
that.
The sort of things that you saw in Vicksburg or around Richmond and Petersburg in Virginia are the things that were almost universal across battlefields in World War I.
Exactly, right? Because I think when we think of, you know, trench warfare, we automatically think of World War I, and rightfully so. So this was a little interesting tidbit that I didn't know about.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Right. All righty. So let's move forward in history a little bit, changing tactics a little, in a lot of different ways, I guess I should say. Who should we look at next? Maybe P.T. Barnum?
Oh, let's look at Barnum. So, I like his initials.
I wonder why that is, P.T.
I wouldn't know.
Now, did you know what the P.T. stood for before you started looking
at this? Phineas Taylor.
That's right. And I didn't know this as well, that apparently his family called him Tail, T-A-L-E.
Oh, okay.
I think that was the...
I didn't know that either.
That was the nickname that his family had for him. A lot of biographies have been written about P.T. Barnum, and we have another one now, right? Another one now, and this is by Robert Wilson. It is called Barnum, An American Life. And a lot of the reviews about Wilson's book says he's maybe a little too enthralled with Barnum, and you get a little
It's hard not to be.
Yeah.
However, the author is the editor of the American Scholar,
yes,
which is the magazine of the Phi Beta Kappa Society.
Yes.
So maybe he's less prone to that than some other people might be. I think his take is that Barnum, of course, was an almost complete humbug.
Yes. Self-described, yes.
That's what people wanted of him.
Right.
And some of his more objectionable characteristics to people today were things that echoed his society and were not considered obnoxious. And you have things. There's a movie called The Greatest Show on Earth that presents Barnum in a much more sympathetic light. And then there are shows that have him, and books too, as some kind of heavy. And I'm always tempted to think that perhaps the real story is somewhere in between.
Somewhere
the
in
two.
Between, right? Now, he had a very long career spanning, you know, most of the 19th century. He was someone who, though he thought as a young child that he had this inheritance that was coming to him that was,
Ivy Island.
Yes, right. And it come to find out, I think around the age of 12, that this piece of property that his Uncle Finn had left him, right? And he begged and begged and begged his parents to take him to see what would, you know, soon become his. And eventually they did. I think it was around 12 or so. And he finds out it's sort of, you know, this you know, unruly swamp.
Right.
And it was sort of one of the, you know, great family practical jokes. So it gives you a little bit of insight into, I think, how Barnum grew up, but you know, relatively not wealthy when he was growing up, and then made a fortune, lost some fortunes, made some fortunes again. He was pretty darn good about the art of making money, which
that was really his entire thing. And if you look at his productions from a modern perspective, even. Some of the things he did to make money were terrific risks. He paid Jenny Lind royally to come over here.
She was the Swedish opera singer?
Yeah, and he paid her money he didn't have. He had to take out loans, and thank heavens for him at that time, it turned out.
Right, or the Fiji mermaid. I don't know how much Barnum paid for the Fiji mermaid, but I believe in what I was reading earlier this week that the person who had the Fiji mermaid prior to Barnum had paid, I think, roughly what would have been the equivalent of maybe, I can't remember what I read, maybe $1,000. I mean, it was a significant amount of money. And of course, this, if people don't know what the Fiji mermaid was, it was some sort of
you know, concoction between, I think I read an orangutan and a baboon and some sort of fish all stitched together and desiccated.
Yes. One thing I think I should point out, since it came up already for another person, is he also was a member of the state legislature.
He was. I did not know that about Barnum.
Yes.
And later in his life, he actually thought about running for president. And oddly enough, he was thinking, well, who should be his running mate? And he thought, maybe someone from Indiana. And so, obviously, in today's climate, people tend to make a lot of comparisons.
Oh, yeah.
Between Barnum and some other folks, because Barnum was good at selling ideas, selling himself. He had a very aggrandized view of himself and his accomplishments, and would even try to claim huge successes out of trips overseas that might have been sort of failures. And then there was a note in some of the reviews of Robert Wilson's biography I was reading that said, well, you know, he tended to tell certain people how much money he made on these ventures of his. And at the same time, to his creditors, he would say, no, I lost so much money on this.
Yeah, yeah. He was very good at shadow accounting. The other thing that interested me that I did not know is later in his career, he specialized, he wrote a couple of books anyway, about exposing people who were humbugging. He had a particular hatred, apparently, for spiritualists and mediums and that sort of thing, and wrote a couple of books on exactly how they accomplished what they seemed to accomplish.
That's very interesting, knowing that, you know, he was really a king of not only how to sell sort of hoaxes to his audience, but how to gin up excitement and anticipation for these events as well. And I think Robert Wilson in his biography kind of looks at Barnum as having a relationship with his audience. And
he did. I think Barnum felt like it was his job to produce a wow factor. It really didn't have any relationship to reality, because that wasn't what the audience was looking for. That's what the audience was looking to be entertained.
Yes.
And he'd do it in whatever way he possibly could.
Right. And so for like with the Fiji Mermaid, he, you know, when he purchased the Fiji Mermaid, you know, wasn't just, okay, let me put up posters and, you know, get people to come. He said, oh, he had to develop sort of this pre-campaign of getting, you know, letters written from different places in the United States. Of course, they're all coming from Barnum.
Right.
Getting.
Oh, he thought it out well. Right. Apparently, he spent months practicing before he introduced Tom Thumb.
Ah, yes. And his campaign with Tom Thumb, especially overseas, earned him quite a bit of money.
It did.
That was one of his major successes. Of course, most people, I think, also know that Barnum doesn't have a great track record when it comes to racism. And
yeah.
At one point in time...
That would be fair to say.
Yeah, at one point in time, it does say that he might have actually owned some slaves temporarily. Of course, most people know the story with Joyce Heth, African-American woman, woman about 80 or so, who purportedly was George Washington's nursemaid. And he definitely, you know, made a fair amount of money, not only with Joyce Heth and her quote-unquote act, right? But also once this woman died. When she died, he held a public autopsy to sort of challenge people to determine how old she was. And so even in death, he seemed to have used her.
He did. And some of this is kind of interesting, because when he did embrace politics, and he did this before the Civil War, he was quite anti-slavery.
Right.
I guess people do have changes of mind.
Well, when he started out, he seemed like he was either pro-slavery or didn't really. But later in his life, he became anti.
Quite anti.
Right. Yeah. And when he was in the state legislature, that was in Connecticut, if I'm correct.
Yes, it was.
He actually did also try to pass laws that enfranchised African Americans. So it's all like you were saying. It's hard to put individuals in clear-cut boxes when they've had some good aspects and some not so good aspects to their lives.
Learning aspects to all of us.
Right, right. And some reviews of Wilson's books, Wilson kind of says, well, look, no, Barnum got better. And some reviewers say, well, better is a relative term. He definitely did have some growth. Let me give our listeners a little bit of a taste of Robert Wilson's Barnum in American Life. I did find his writing to be engaging even from the very first page. So maybe I'll give about, the first paragraph or so. In 1842, the man who would become America's greatest showman received a visit from a museum owner in Boston who needed his help. Moses Kimball had made his way to P.T. Barnum's office in New York City with a box that, he baldly claimed, contained the remains of a mermaid. When the box was opened and the object was unwrapped, what Barnum saw was a shrunken, blackish thing about 3 feet long that seemed pretty obviously to be the head and torso of a monkey joined to the lower portion of a large fish. Kimball had a story to go with this desiccated corpse, something about its being discovered by sailors in the South Seas, but he had no idea what to do with it. Although the two men had not previously met, their establishments had collaborated on several acts and exhibitions. Barnum had recently acquired a dusty old museum on Lower Broadway, dubbed it the American Museum, and dedicated it to natural history, art and artifacts, performances, and the exuberant miscellany of anything that caught his eye. The growing renown of the new museum, along with Barnum's already established reputation as an impresario with a knack for publicity, made him a logical person for Kimball to go to for advice. So that's the beginning of the Fiji Mermaid story.
Yes, and one of the articles, one of the reviews that I read ends with this passage. It's from Barnum. The public appears disposed to be amused, even when they are conscious of being deceived.
Right.
And there may be other lessons for other situations in that quote, too.
Right, absolutely. And, whether there needed to be another biography of Barnum, I don't know, but we'll have to see if Robert Wilson provides a different perspective. What I would like to see is, what can we learn from Barnum's life, a century or so ago to today? Where do we stand? What do we make of it? And some other reviewers have kind of asked that question as well. Elizabeth Colbert, I don't know if it's Colbert, who's a staff writer at The New Yorker, she says, talking about how Americans were drawn to such humbug. Why they are still being drawn to it is a puzzle that now more than ever demands our attention. So maybe Wilson's book might give us some insights there. Now, P.T., we only have 10 minutes left.
Oh, dear.
I don't know if we want to take a look at... we have two books we would love to spend, I think, a fair amount of time on. Do we want to take a look more at Casey Sepp's book, Furious Hours?
Why don't we do that? Because that's a fascinating story, and I think we should.
Right.
Casey Sepp, if you have not run into her, is a staff writer for The New Yorker. She grew up in Talbot County, which is the first county across the bridge on the Maryland's eastern shore. If you go that way, I have been that way several times. I haven't been there in ages, but it used to be quite a pretty place. And she has done some very, very interesting articles on a variety of subjects in The New Yorker, But her specialty lately has been the writer Harper Lee.
Yes, absolutely. So the book Furious Hours, the subtitle is Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee. And I think this book is a mix. And you're right, PT, readers or listeners can actually go online and find Casey Sepp in The New Yorker actually writing about this, kind of giving a preview of...
Right. She actually did an article for The New Yorker before she came out with the book.
Right. One is titled Harper Lee's Abandoned True Crime Novel. And this is her debut book. Like you said, she's not new to writing, but this is her debut book. And it's a little bit of a mix of... a legal trial, a sort of murder thriller, as well as the interactions between, you know, a famous writer, Harper Lee, and all of the individuals involved in the original events.
Well, it's a fascinating event, even before Harper Lee gets involved.
Yes.
And Harper Lee gets involved, and that makes it even more interesting. And then Harper Lee had actually planned to write a novel based on it. She never did. There's the story of why she did or didn't.
Right.
There's the story of what happened to her papers after she died.
Right.
And so there's quite a lot to cover here.
It's a mystery wrapped, you know, what's the phrase? An enigma wrapped in a
book. Yes.
Right? That's exactly, I think, what this whole story is. And so let's give our listeners a little bit of a synopsis in about our 7 minutes left we have. So this starts in Alexander City, Alabama, right, where there is a gentleman by the name of Reverend Willie Maxwell who becomes accused of murder. Now, P.T., he's not just accused of murder once.
No. Relatives of Reverend Maxwell, relatives who he's taken out insurance policies on, keep on dying in the strangest ways. It happens five or six times.
It happens five times. A lot of them are, quote unquote, automobile accidents. You know, a very unlucky family, I suppose.
Yeah, especially when they found out that the victim of the automobile accident was actually strangled.
Yes, exactly. It's hard for a car to do that, but apparently
it does
come about.
It?
Now, Reverend Willie Maxwell was an African-American, and this, of course, is Alabama in sort of the Wallace South. And he gets put on trial for these murders, and he needs someone to defend him. And I think one of the main persons in Casey Sepp's story is the lawyer Tom Radney, who was this sort of Kennedy liberal, you know, Caucasian, white, Kennedy liberal, one of the few lawyers, I think, who was willing to defend African-American client at the time in this particular town in Alabama. And he does. He takes the Reverend Maxwell on as a client for all five times. And then eventually, the last person in Maxwell's family to have found not so good ends was his stepdaughter. And at the stepdaughter's funeral, I believe, the stepdaughter's uncle shoots and kills Reverend Maxwell outright. And now all of a sudden, this person now needs a lawyer.
And lawyer Radney takes him on.
He does have to write to get permission that he can now defend someone, you know, right. So in part, it's really this interesting legal story about, a legal champion in this small town in Alabama. In the courtroom for that trial happened to be Harper Lee. You know, she was living in New York at the time, but she comes to Alabama about 150 miles from where she grew up, right?
Right.
And she and Tom Radney, I guess, developed some kind of correspondence and relationship and a professional relationship. And she says she's going to write this story, I think, akin to In Cold Blood. She had helped Truman Capote with that.
Right.
Right. And so Radney basically loaned her all of his documentation, all of his paperwork, and lo and behold, so many years later, so many decades later, we still don't have a book on Reverend Maxwell. Now, Radney's family, I think, received a very short chapter from Harper Lee at
they
some point.
They did.
Yeah.
And, the profile I read gave me the idea that it wasn't really even polished as a chapter. It was just something between notes and something
right.
final.
But she kept telling Radney, oh, I'm working on it. It's almost done. It's almost done. It's almost done. And the fan,
how very writer-like.
I know, right? Yes. Do not ask me how long I've been working on mine, PT. Tom Radney, he did pass away in 2011. And so his family, they would like to have at least his documentation back. And, you know, where that went is also a big mystery. And so
right.
Casey Sepp is really weaving all of these together. Let me give our listeners a little bit of taste of the prologue. Nobody recognized her. Harper Lee was well known, but not by sight. And if she hadn't introduced herself, it's unlikely that anyone in the courtroom would have figured out who she was. Hundreds of people were crowded into the gallery, filling the wooden benches that squeaked whenever someone moved, or leaning against the back wall if they hadn't arrived in time for a seat. Late September wasn't late enough for the Alabama heat to have died down, and the air conditioning in the courthouse wasn't working, so the women waved fans while the men's suits grew damp under their arms and around their collars. The spectators whispered from time to time, and every so often they laughed, an uneasy laughter that evaporated whenever the judge quieted them.
Doesn't it actually sound like a description of the courtroom in To Kill a Mockingbird?
It absolutely does. And I wonder if Casey Sepp is actually playing with that.
I'm sure. I hope I didn't give the impression that Casey Sepp is some hick from the Eastern Shore.
No.
She went to school in Harvard. She got a degree from Oxford.
She was a Rhodes Scholar.
A Rhodes Scholar. So this is a very sharp woman.
Absolutely. And if you read any of her New Yorker writing and other
her New Yorker writings are pretty special.
Right. Or even, like I said, if you just even pulling up the prologue to this book, she draws you in immediately.
Did you know she got her master's from Oxford in theology? I thought that was interesting.
Right, but she also has a degree from Harvard in English. Right, so a nice combination. Again, this is her debut book.
Yes,
but it is not her only form of writing. All right, well, PT, we are already almost out of time. I want to tell our listeners. Usually following us is Tim Huggenboom with Not Fade Away, a program both you and I love to listen to, especially as
Absolutely.
We're driving home. Now, Tim is going to be moving his show starting next week to 11 a.m. on Thursdays. And I know, PT, you and I, we're a little biased here. We're really hoping it's only temporary and that he's going to come back Fridays at 1 p.m. But for the time being, don't miss Tim Huggenboom's Not Fade Away Thursdays, starting next week at 11 a.m.
Yes, if you like music, be there at 11 on Thursday.
Right. And PT, I think next week you and I are maybe going to cover another batch of authors from the Savannah Book Festival.
Oh, are we ever? As you said, we have something like 40 to choose from.
I know. We could probably do this for months on end. Until that time, however, PT and I would really like to thank you for listening to Literature Today. Good day and good reading.
Bye, y'all.
The viewpoints expressed in the preceding program were not necessarily those of WRUU, its license holder, or its staff. This is WRUU-LP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings, community radio with global soul.